Bonjour et bienvenue to Nations of Charlemagne, episode 22, Le Ancien Régime. So apologies in advance for the slight sort of schedule kerfuffle. I've had to move a lot of things around at the moment, and this evening was the only time I could actually do this stream. Unfortunately, that means I don't have a script or any sort of a vast series of notes planned, so it's probably going to be a lot more rambling than you're usually accustomed to. Nevertheless, there are a couple of important points I really want to point out at the beginning of the stream. First of all, this stream is taking place in the context of the French presidential elections, and I was able to catch one of the debates between Mélenchon and Zemmour, and Zemmour was explaining to Mélenchon that the main difference in France between the left and the right is that the left sees the beginning of French history in 1789 with the revolution, and the right in France sees the entirety of French history up prior to Charlemagne, all the way to Clovis, as some sort of continuity. In fact, the French Revolution, therefore, doesn't act as some sort of continuity, but almost some sort of breach. And if you look at the traditions of the French right, particularly in the 19th century, that actually makes a lot of sense. So, for example, you have the Legitimists who come in after Napoleon, who, despite the lackeys around Louis XVIII, who support the July Charter, almost universally rejected the legacy of the French Revolution. Then you have the Orleanists, who want to bridge some sort of gap between the revolution and the pre-existing monarchy, often going back to that strange period in time between 1789 and 1792, where France was technically a constitutional monarchy under a citizen king, a citoyen roi. And moving beyond that, then, of course, you even have the Bonapartists. Even though Napoleon would claim that he was the revolution on horseback, that he was the personification of the revolution, a lot of Bonapartism does hark back to the legacy of the pre-French Revolution in particular. Napoleon saw himself as an equivalent of Charlemagne, who very much wanting to restructure Europe along the lines of a new Carolingian empire. And there were many precedents he drew back on. And of course, before Charlemagne, there was also Julius Caesar, albeit that's very consistent with the neoclassical vein of the French revolutionary thinkers. So nevertheless, in French right-wing thought, therefore, you have the idea of a continuity in French history, in which 1789 is a blip or something you want to undo completely. And of course, this later moderates into more sort of right-wing republicanism when you get more advanced into the French Third Republic. So why am I going on this trajectory? Well, because this period of time, which is going to be the focus of this lecture, the 18th century in France, is one of these weird periods in history where virtually everything is assessed in context of what happens at the end or what supersedes it, in this case, the French Revolution from 1789 onwards. And that doesn't tend to be a very good or constructive way of reviewing history, because it assumes that the contemporaries had some sort of understanding of what was later going to happen. Many of them didn't. Many of them had an inkling of what was to come. One of the most famous quotes you can subscribe to this period, or almost the reference of decadence in 18th century France, is this quote, which is often attributed either to Louis XV. By the way, Louis XV is pictured here in this rather ridiculous get-up. Nevertheless, I will point out that I actually prefer Louis XV French style compared to Louis XIV style. The quote is, "Après nous le déluge," after us, the deluge. And this quote is often taken to mean that his reign was that of debauchery excess without any consideration for the future, that the end of his reign represented some form of grand sort of terminus in French history. The deluge, of course, was supposed to refer to the French Revolution. This isn't true. This was actually in most likely a reference to France's absolute disaster in the Seven Years' War, rather than any sort of prophetic reference to the revolution, also possibly a link to Halley's comet passing in 1757. Often when you have comets passing in the pre-scientific revolution days, it often heralds some sort of a portentous doom. So it's very unlikely that this comment sort of becomes apocryphal if it's referring to a prophetic statement in the French Revolution. Nevertheless, it has nevertheless come to assume that. Often, you know, history takes these little tidbits and deracinates it from its context and imposes new meaning on it. And such could be said for the title of this lecture, L'Ancien Régime. Of course, that in French literally means the old regime or the old government. And the implications of this term is that there is a context which you can rightfully ascribe the idea of an ancien regime in France, and then there is a context where it doesn't apply. So if I were to take the left-wing conception of the French Revolution, the ancien regime would essentially be an epithet for the entirety of France's pre-revolutionary monarchical history. Something which inevitably must be swept away by the progress envisioned by the philosophes and the doing away with the church, doing away with absolute monarchy, doing away with feudalism, and arriving at a more harmonious, more egalitarian society as envisaged in the original Declaration of Rights of Man in the French Revolution. Nevertheless, this is, I think, going from one extreme to the other. The other extreme, of course, is to say that the whole idea of an ancien regime is anathema. It was just simply the continuation of the Kingdom of France. And I don't believe that's a very useful epithet either. The ancien regime, as contemporaries envisaged it, very much did exist. It comes into being in some serious force in 1788, when you have de Calonne's failure to assemble the Council of Notables to convene some sort of general reform program to deal with the debt problem in France. Thereafter, the French system is almost universally considered in desperate need of reform. At the time, it is through the mechanism of the Estates General, which hadn't been summoned since 1614 in the early reign of Louis XIII. Therefore, this idea of a l'ancien regime was something that contemporaries just before the French Revolution felt as referring to the fact that the king, Louis XVI, was unable to reform what was a decaying and rigid, stagnant institution. And in many senses, I think that is the correct way of observing l'ancien regime. It represents the failure of French absolutism before the French Revolution. And I think the failure of this regime to adapt successfully, to modify itself, and in many ways contain the revolution, or even take the revolutionaries and use the purpose of the revolutionaries against the true sort of enemies of Louis XIV, the notables, the members of the Second Estate, the nobles who are guarding their privileges. None of this happens, and the regime is washed away. Even the calendar is washed away as well. The year begins in 1792 as the year one. So this whole idea of an ancien regime very much is felt in the contemporaries and those who are acting, participating in the French Revolution, especially when we have the deposition of Louis XVI in 1792. So we can't do away with this description. Well, I think another way to look at it is, take, for example, this image here, l'ancien regime. If you're learning about this in school, you'll no doubt be familiar with this image on the left, which is, again, another contemporary cartoon, the Third Estate supporting the excesses of a delinquent and absentee Second Estate and First Estate, referring to the nobles and the clergy. And of course, this is very much indicative of the grievances summed up in Abbé Dissier's Third Estate, What is the Third Estate? Declaring essentially a manifesto for the Third Estate as, you know, almost reducing the members and nobility and clergy to a point of irrelevance. Nevertheless, I think referring to this as a problem with feudalism is an incredibly superficial and reductive way of looking at this period and identifying what is happening in France in the 18th century. Feudalism was far more existent in Russia, in Prussia, and in Austria at the time. If anything, the French Revolution, the pre-French Revolutionary France, was relatively lacking in terms of the stability of its feudal institutions. Something I have contained on this channel is that French absolutism really is a remedy which unmakes many of the core elements of feudalism, and it ushers in a form of modern centralized government. And this is very much the view of Alexis de Tocqueville, who you can see on the right here, a very famous French commenter from the middle of the 19th century, who is more famous for his ruminations on democracy in America. Nevertheless, he also wrote extensively on the idea of l'ancien régime. And to his mind, there was in fact a continuity between the reforming zeal, centralizing zeal of l'ancien régime and the work of the French Revolution. If anything, to him, the French Revolution was simply the culmination of the centralizing efforts and the absolutist efforts of the previous governments, really since Cardinal de Richelieu. So this is, again, an interesting perspective, the Tocquevillian perspective, which really puts in contrast this whole idea of l'ancien régime as fundamentally separate from that of the progress of the French Revolution. Here's a good graph to make this case. We have the Parlement de Paris, which is the closest thing France has to a Senate or some form of a supreme judicial authority or some form of legislature, even though it never really evolves into one. Nevertheless, nor does it evolve into a body capable of representing the entire French nation. As you can see by the myriad parliaments all across France, which is again the legacy of the Hundred Years' War. After the Hundred Years' War, Charles VII libertinely begins to establish parliaments in areas which were taken from the English. Then you have Normandy, then you have Brittany, and then you have areas in the east and the north, which represent France's various conquests at the expense of the Holy Roman Empire. And if you look at this map, what Tocqueville therefore refers to is this idea of the paire d'élection, or the territories which are roughly corresponding to the Parliament of Paris, with the inclusion of the Parliament of Bordeaux and the Parliament du Rouen. And this essentially represents some form of centralized regime in France, whereas you have the paix d'état and the paix d'imposition on the frontiers, which are guaranteed with their own sort of rights, their own provincial notables, and have a degree of a legal authority independent from Paris. But certainly in this idea of the paix d'élection, you have something resembling what would later become the département system with the French Revolution. In the case of late 18th century France, this is the idea of the généralité, or the provinces, and these have a history dating back all the way to King Francis I of France in the 16th century. So you can really see this as a continuing evolution of the institutions of France toward centralization, which gives the press, gets essentially the impetus for the reforming zeal of the French revolutionaries, albeit under the guidance of a new ruling elite compared to the previous ruling elite, the nobility, the clergy, and the king, or if anything, you can say the king, often in contrast with the nobility and the clergy. So if we look at this in terms of the system of French absolutism, one therefore has to ask the question, why did it fail? Why did it stagnate? Why did it become the ancien régime, incapable of reforming itself? And why did it necessarily have to have a French Revolution? What are the implications which lead us to the French Revolution, which characterizes this entire period of the 18th century France as l'ancien régime? Because as Tocqueville would like us to remind us, there are 37 généralités, and he essentially extrapolates from this the fact that France was governed by a small clique appointed from Paris, 36 or so entendants, who essentially governed France as, in addition to the role of the Controller General of Finances, who controlled many overlapping jurisdictions, and often in the face of a dilettante absentee king controlled by his mistresses, Madame de Pompadour and Madame de Barry, the effect of France was essentially that there was an administrative cadre or a managerial elite ruling France with no reference to the nobility, or many of the ancient rights which one would associate with feudal France. And one of the things you routinely see about the nobility and even the clergy during this time is absenteeism, the idea that the clergy and the nobility have forgotten what their primary role is in the system. Therefore, it is almost post-feudal. And referring to it as this simple image on the left here is actually very much confusing our image, especially when you understand in the early history of France that the noblesse de robe, the administrators which Louis XIV had relied so often in order to actually administer France, were actually drafted from the Third Estate based on their ability to contribute fiscally to the French monarchy. So with that necessary sort of context established, I'll just briefly sort of summarize the main chronology of events here. So as intimated on the previous lecture, the War of the Spanish Succession, the time around the death of Louis XIV is incredibly tumultuous. So Louis XIV is at war virtually for the entirety of his reign, with a couple of exceptions. In the last 30 years of his reign, he's virtually continuously at war, either in the war, the 9 Years' War, and then the War of Spanish Succession. And it is during the end of this war that France is faced with a succession crisis, which has major implications for the future of the monarchy. In 1711, in the last few years of the War of Spanish Succession, France is now essentially holding on to its territory. Philippe of Anjou, one of the grandsons of Louis XIV, has successfully established himself in Spain, albeit all of Spain's empire in Europe is being taken away by the Habsburgs and the British. But in 1711, Le Grand Dauphin, the eldest son of Louis XIV, dies. And all of a sudden, it is the grandson of Louis XIV, the Duc de Bourguignon, the Duke of Burgundy, who has become the heir to the throne. And the Duke of Burgundy is an interesting case, and again, of sort of what-if-ism, when you look at what could have happened to the French monarchy, because the Duke of Burgundy was considered essentially part of a intellectual movement, intellectual circle, many ascribing to him the idea that he was some sort of Louis the Ninth resurrected, a Saint Louis, a figure of reforming zeal, but also tremendous religious piety. And the implication here is that he wished to reform the absolute monarchy in France to something more akin to the regime under Louis IX in the 13th century, something resembling a working, more effective system of feudalism under a pious saint king. This, of course, doesn't come to pass. His wife, Adelaide de Savoy, she dies very quickly, passes on the illness, not only to him, where after he dies, but also his eldest son. And thereafter, it is a younger son of the Duc de Bourguignon, who would later become Louis XV, who is only one at the time of his father's death, who is suddenly the heir to the throne of France by Salic law, the great-grandson of Louis XIV, to put this in perspective of how many of his heirs have already predeceased him, making this moment all the more remarkable. So all this hope which had been put on the Duke of Burgundy has now gone, and there is now a looming succession crisis in France. The figure I have on the left here, Philippe II d'Orléans, the nephew of Louis XIV, is accused of poisoning Louis XV to advance his own claim to the regency and perhaps even the throne of France itself. He is considered a dabbling in various sort of dark rituals, sorcery, alchemy. All of these things that put this idea that he was responsible for the murder or the poisoning of the young Duke of Burgundy for the rest of his life. Nevertheless, he is able to establish himself as the regent in spite of the will of Louis XIV, whereby he raises his various bastards to princes of the blood who can actually try and curtail the influence of his nephew, the Duc d'Orléans. But added to that, it's not just the Duc d'Orléans, which the young, now 4-year-old king, Louis XV, has to worry about. He also needs to worry about his uncle in Spain, who also has a claim on the French throne, who is actually the heir to the throne, as Louis XV is but a boy, and wants to establish his claim. And inspired by the zeal of Elisabetta Farnese, the Queen of Spain, Spain prosecutes a war against France in order to regain parts of its former empire, but also to force the issue of the succession and establish who was previously Philippe of Anjou, now Philip the Fifth of Spain, definitively as heir to the throne of France, if not possibly king as well. This enters into the period of what we have, one of the strangest periods in French history, where France is allied with England. against the Spanish, to prevent the Spanish trying to force their own claimant on the French throne after France, having spent the previous 10 years or longer trying to stand up for the rights of Philip V, who was the nephew of Louis XV. So it is an incredibly tumultuous time in which the young Louis XV is ascending to the throne. Nevertheless, in spite of all of this, France enters into a protracted period of peace after an incompetent government led by d'Orléans. Later, you have the more stable government of Cardinal de Florey, you can see in the center, and France is able to recover financially after the disastrous effects of nearly 30 years of war. And this is something I want to also contextualize, is that the harvest crises of the 1780s is often seen as a major implicating factor in the French Revolution. And this is true. This is something the privation suffered by the various peasants, but also the sans-culottes in Paris shouldn't be overlooked. The vast increase in the population throughout the 18th century is another driving factor. But the French population suffered the most incredible privations throughout the course of Louis XIV's reign and the early reign of Louis XV. And yet they were never so bold as to try and depose the king or facilitate his removal from Versailles, as was the case in October of 1789. Bear in mind that the population in Paris was seen as relatively reactionary, even a couple of centuries before, when in Paris was seen as a major Catholic center of power, so much so that they denied Henry IV coming into the city unless he would convert to Catholicism. All of these interesting implications. And with the minority, there was a sense of opportunity for many of the less radical French nobles, the more moderate French radicals, who wanted not only to undermine the system of French absolutism, but also wanted to reconsider some of Louis XIV's religious policies. The signature policy, of course, being the revocation of the Edict of Fontainebleau in 1685, which forced the Huguenots, the French Protestants, to flee or convert Catholicism. Nevertheless, Louis XV prevented any sort of major concession to the Protestants. There was a brief Protestant revival in the beginning of the 18th century, which was very quickly snuffed out. And you also have the ongoing crisis of Jansenism, which is a Catholic heresy which originated some 60 years before, which had quite a following in French intellectual circles throughout the second half of the 17th century and for the duration of the 18th century. And many of these figures then went on to contribute to the sort of revolutionary zeal post 1789. But nevertheless, Louis XV was faithful to his great-grandfather's legacy, held true to his own interpretation of the church. But at the same time, the nobility in France has sort of abandoned this idea of almost representing or orbiting the Sun King as some form of embodiment of perfection or Christ's representative or vice-regent on earth. And I have here a chapter from Hippolyte de Tonnes on the origins of contemporary France, volume one, which talks about something which is rather radical in contrast to so much of what we talked about in this series. We've talked about the French Wars of Religion. We've talked about the crisis of Jansenism. We've talked about the Edict of Fontainebleau. We've talked about conciliarism versus papal authority, Gallicanism versus ultramontanism. But we haven't talked about a fall of religion in France and a general sort of wave of complete skepticism in France, which is sort of ushered in with the period of the philosophes. And this really enters into how I think you really ought to consider the 18th century in France if you're not going to look at it from a deterministic point of view of everything which originates in the French Revolution, which is a soft power and hard power struggle between France and Great Britain to establish intellectual, economic, and military hegemony, not just in Europe, but in the world. This is the ongoing struggle which defines the French-English relationship in the 18th century. And it is very much in this context of this struggle that France in the 18th century and what happens in 1789 really has to be understood. So given that I'm establishing this idea of the context of this schism between England and France, this intellectual, this military, this also religious schism, if you go back to the Anglicans, if you go back to the Jacobites serving in the French army, and the Huguenots, of course, serving in the British army, what starts off this period is this brief alliance between France and England, which albeit becomes virtually irrelevant by the 1730s. And by the 1730s, France actually looks like it's going to win this struggle between England. So just to establish the state of affairs, Britain, of course, has the 13 colonies. The Dutch have the largest presence in the East Indies and also in India at this time. But nevertheless, the French and the British are finally beginning to establish footholds in India. The French have control over modern day Canada, Louisiana, what was called Nouvelle France, or the colony of New France. They are setting up the various colonies in the Mississippi Basin and in Quebec colony. And the French are the major colonial competitor to the British alongside that of the Spanish Empire, which is now being brought in line with France. So bearing in mind that the Spanish Empire is now allied to France, in the 1730s, you have a war which is very much peripheral to our consideration, which is the Polish War of Succession. The effects of the Polish War of Succession is that the Habsburgs are kicked out of many of their possessions in Italy, and a Bourbon becomes king of Naples and will later become king of Spain as Charles III. Now, the implications for this are that for the first time, France is able to benefit from its alliance, from its strategy of supporting Philip V, the Duke of Anjou, as King of Spain, because now Spain, from being an enemy, has now become an ally. Louis XV has had several children with his Polish wife, Mary. The throne in France looks secure. So does the line of Spanish Bourbons at the same time. And so with the convocation of the Pacte de Famille, France looks indomitable, essentially, in Europe. It is the major power. It has a major ally. It has a major overseas empire. And it is allied with the greatest overseas empire at this time, which is Spain, which in many ways completely trumps the nascent British Empire in the early 18th century. And you really have a confirmation of all of this, what I'm talking about, the relative French superiority vis-a-vis the English, with the War of Austrian Succession and Maurice de Saxe's coup de grâce at the Fontenoy in 1745. You have the Austrian War of Succession, which was discussed in the previous episode on dualism. Just to briefly summarize what happens there, the Emperor of Austria, the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, Charles VI, has no legitimate male issue. He tries to pass on the throne to his daughter, Mary Theresa. He gets acknowledgement throughout this for all of Europe from the Pragmatic Sanction, with a couple of exceptions. Prussia, under Frederick II, Frederick the Great, famously does not recognize the Pragmatic Sanction, lays claim when Charles VI dies to the duchies of Silesia, wins a battle against the Austrians, which brings in the Bavarians, and by the Bavarians, their proxy, their allies, the French. The Bavarians do very well in the beginning. There's even briefly a Bavarian emperor, after which the Bavarians don't do very well, but that's almost irrelevant for the conversation, because what happens amidst all of this is that the French win a great victory against the Austrians and against the British at the Battle of Fontenoy in modern-day Belgium. The effect of this is that Belgium is brought in effectively to French occupation, and the dream of Louis XIV to establish French outposts, annexing most of the land on the left bank of the Rhine, now finally seems like a possibility under Louis XV, the beloved. France has been delivered from a plague at this time. Louis XV has finally taken the reins of direct government in imitation of his great-grandfather, Louis XIV. He's dispensed with the services of all of his regents who have dominated him over the previous 30 years, and he is now militarily successful with his Huguenot general, Maurice de Saxe. All of this, however, is not to pass. This is the high point of Louis XV's reign. I think if he died here, history would have been much kinder to him than what would happen over the next 30 years of his rather debauched and disastrous reign. because he is unable to capitalize off the success of the Battle of Fontenay. He makes no serious effort to hold on to the Austrian possessions in Belgium, the Austrian Netherlands, which would have given France control over modern-day Belgium. Instead, he returns these territories to Austria in 1748. This is actually an act which is lauded at the time, as essentially Louis XV is considered the great sort of stabilizer of the European order, however, and a great peacemaker again. And France has already won its great moment of glory at the Battle of Fontenoy, so much so that Napoleon would actually later claim that Fontenoy gave the Ancien Régime another 30 years of life, given that Napoleon himself believed that glory was an indispensable tool in dispensing with your various economic hardships at home. Nevertheless, all of this is incredibly short-lived. The period of the 1750s is essentially the last sort of moment where France could be considered the dominant power in Europe, something which all contemporaries really felt was they all looked to France culturally, intellectually, and militarily as the exemplar, the superlative nation in France. So the 1750s is the last sort of time before everything begins going terribly wrong for the French when you contrast this with their relationship with the English. Louis XV gets involved in an alliance with the Austrians, an alliance with the Russians, called the Diplomatic Revolution, whereby the Austrians entice the French to support them in their war against the Prussians to regain Silesia as part of this diplomatic revolution, which is actually not the result of Louis XV, but more the result of his mistress, Madame de Pompadour, brings him into this alliance with his France's perpetual enemy, Austria, in order to regain the territory which he had just essentially surrendered at the end of the 1748 war. So France has essentially embarked on an unnecessary war, which it didn't need to fight, had it been able to secure the gains of the previous war, the War of the Austrian Succession, in order to essentially serve the political ambitions of the Empress of Austria, Mary Theresa. However, Prussia has also formed an alliance with England, because England, who again, the King of England, George II, is also the Elector of Hanover. He is concerned about the possession of his territories in Hanover. And as part of this treaty, this alliance with Austria, France has been given free rein to occupy Hanover whenever it so chooses. And this precipitates war between Great Britain and France, spurred on by William Pitt the Younger. And at first, France does very well. Hanover is more or less occupied. And crucially, they win a crucial victory at Minorca, what the greater British outpost in the Western Mediterranean next to Gibraltar. Gibraltar, of course, had been established by the British in the previous war against the Spanish in the War of Succession. Minorca was one of their great bases. And the French were able to take Minorca, which precipitated the execution of Britain's commanding admiral and a major reappraisal of the naval code to be extremely harsh on notions of surrendering, but also mutiny, the code of George II. After 1758, France, you know, looks to be in a very strong position. They've been able to defeat the British navally. Their colonies are holding on, and the Prussian king, Frederick II, has been defeated at the Battle of Kolin. All of this is quickly undone when France begins to be defeated navally in every single sphere, even around the coast of Brittany. It begins losing control of its colonies in Canada, and it loses a crucial victory, a crucial battle, against the Prussians at Rossbach in 1758, which invites calamity and stagnation for the French forces thereafter. The Prussians hold on. The Russians essentially advance, but they're unable to deal out a decisive victory despite the defeats of Frederick II at Kunersdorf. and the Austrians are the ones, the only ones benefiting from France's continued involvement in the war are the Austrians. France is essentially servicing Austria's diplomatic aims, whilst France is also losing all of its colonial empire to the British. Now it has lost any contact with the colonies due to their complete destruction of their navies in the Channel and in the Atlantic Sea in the Bay of Biscay. So by 1763, when you finally have de Choiseul concluding peace with the British, it is absolute disaster. France, beginning this period, having established itself as the greatest nation in Europe, but also a major colonial power, something that could have potentially, again, you know, beaten the English in the long term, is decisively defeated by the British. So much so that 1763 really decides the fate of not only the sort of short-term rivalry between Britain and France in the 18th century, but the fact that we all in the West speak English as a lingua franca dates back to the French disaster in this conflict of 1756 to 1763. France has essentially been cheated out of its maritime possessions, and it is essentially bankrupt. And thereafter, Louis XV has to resort to a rather novel strategy to gain anything out of France's much reduced position. Whereas other European powers have great rulers, so we're talking Catherine II, the Great in Russia, Frederick II, the Great in Prussia, and Mary Theresa and Joseph II in Austria. Britain also has great rulers at this time. The king is more or less receding into the background, but you have great prime ministers like Robert Walpole, and leaders of the house like William Pitt the Elder. In contrast to this, France has really no one. The king, from all the hopes that were pinned on him from the beginning, the king has entered into a protracted period of disgrace. From being dominated by rather competent regents like de Forest in his early reign, he now sort of exhibiting his principal vice, which is his obsession, his love of women. In particular, he falls for one Madame de Pompadour, who also becomes the patron of the philosophes, the French sort of cultural enlightenment around the court in Versailles, and begins trying to patronize limiting sort of elements of reform in France. In stark contrast, by the way, to the Queen, who has her own court, and who is very much advocating for traditional Catholicism. And it's within this context that we really have the arrival of the philosophes. And what I talk about, this is more than a military defeat. This is very much a economic and cultural defeat for France as well, because the beginning, the inception of the philosophes, the sort of first sort of great eminent writer among them is really de Montesquieu. Montesquieu is writing his separation of powers in the context of what he believes as the failure of the French political system and the great success of the British political system. In fact, he was more or less wrong in terms of his constitutional appraisal of the separation of powers and his notion of the king in parliament. He wrongly believed that these were separate powers, the judiciary, the legislature, and the executive. Nevertheless, this had such a profound role on French thinkers that really he is the thinker par excellence who informs this sort of Englishification of the French nobility and the philosophes going forward. In terms of this sort of moderate iteration, you have, of course, great thinkers such as Diderot, who is more or less responsible for the Encyclopédie, along with D'Alembert, you can see here on the right. The other, of course, great thinker is, of course, Voltaire. Voltaire, who is more or less known for his great anti-clerical polemics and his great wit and his, again, his legendary poetry, probably the most famous work by Voltaire is Candide. The effect of Voltaire essentially was to enchant and enamor himself, not just with the French high society, the Salon Society in France, but also he received the patronage of many great rulers, so-called enlightened rulers in Europe at this time, including Frederick II of Prussia and Catherine II of Russia. And the implications of this is that this idea of enlightenment or tolerance, everything which stood in stark contrast to the ruling style of Louis XIV, all the very conception of French absolutism is being whittled away by the constant anti-clerical attacks and agitation of figures such as Voltaire, although I don't believe Voltaire was in any way capable of construing the implications of his polemical attacks on the church. But nevertheless, this leads to a considerable phenomena that we notice among the upper society in France, which is the state of unbelief. So we move on beyond sort of a schism in France from the effects of the wars of religion, from the various religious controversies, from the conversion and the departure of the Huguenots, to this relative environment of religious skepticism. So bringing this back to this this quote I have from Hippolyte Tong: "Let us follow the progress of philosophy in the upper class. Religion is the first to receive the severest attacks. The small group of skeptics, which is hardly perceptible under Louis XIV, has obtained its recruits in the dark in the 1698, the Palatine, the mother of the regent." And again, this is referring back to Philip II during the early reign of Louis XV. Writes that we scarcely meet a young woman who is not ambitious of being an atheist. Under the regency, unbelief comes out into open daylight. "I doubt," says this lady again in 1722, "if in all Paris 100 individuals can be found, either ecclesiastics or laymen, who have any true faith or even belief in our Lord. It makes one tremble. The position of an ecclesiastic in society is already difficult. He is looked upon, apparently, as either a puppet or a dicky. The moment we appear," says one of them, "we are forced into discussion. We are called upon to prove, for example, the unity of prayer to an unbeliever in God, and the necessity of fasting to a man who has all his life denied the immortality of the soul. The effort is very irksome. While those who laugh are not on our side. It is not long before the continued scandal of confession tickets and the stubbornness of the bishop in not allowing ecclesiastical property to be taxed, excites opinion against the clergy, and as a matter of course, against religion itself. There is danger," says Barbier in 1751, "that this may end seriously. We may someday see a revolution in this country in favour of Protestantism. The hatred against the priests," writes d'Argenson in 1753, "is carried to extremes. They scarcely show themselves in the streets without being hooted at. As our nation and our century are quite otherwise enlightened, then in the time of Luther, it will be carried far enough. They will expel the priests, abolish the priesthood, and get rid of all revelation and all mystery. One dare not speak on behalf of the clergy in special circles. One is scoffed and regarded as a familiar of the Inquisition. The priests remark that this year there is a diminution of more than one third in the number of communicants. The College of the Jesuits has been deserted. 120 boarders have been withdrawn from these so greatly defamed monks." And of course, this is also with the implication of the general expulsion of the Jesuit order from not just France, but many countries in Europe, Bavaria, Portugal, etc. The Jesuits are very much attacked as, again, papal agents in this overall scheme of religious tolerance and enlightenment. It has been observed also that during the carnival in Paris, the number of masks counterfeiting ecclesiastical dress, bishops, abbés, monks and nuns, was never so great. So deep is this antipathy, the most mediocre books become the rage so long as they are anti-Christian and condemned as such. In 1748, a work by Toussaint called Les Mœurs in favour of natural religion suddenly becomes so famous that there is no one among a certain class of people, writes Barbier, man or woman pretending to be an intellectual who is not eager to read it. People accost each other on their promenades. "Have you read Les Mœurs?" 10 years later, they are beyond deism. Materialism, Barbier further said, is the great grievance. Almost all people of erudition and taste, writes d'Argenson, inveigh against our holy religion. It is attacked on all sides, and what animates unbelievers still more is the efforts made by the devout to compel belief. They publish books which are but little read, debates no longer take place, everything being laughed at while people persist in materialism. These savants, I beg their pardons, these philosophers are insupportable, superficial, overbearing, and fanatic. They preach incessantly, and their avowed doctrine is atheism. You would not believe how openly. Voltaire himself does not satisfy them. One of their lady devotees said of him, he is a bigot, for he is a deist. So even Voltaire is not radical enough for the most fashionable of many of France's upper elite at this time. But nevertheless, I think whilst this sort of indicates a general antipathy, the structure of the system, albeit it's simply an edifice now, it is simply artifice, whilst the entire sort of animating spirit of French civilization is corroding and transitioning into this period of skepticism. And you can say the real origin of the left-right schism in France, the right being towards Catholicism and the left being towards secularism or some variation of atheism. The major sort of implications of that is that at this time, still theoretically at least, France was a Catholic country. And what the philosophes were originally railing against wasn't so much that they wanted to take power. This certainly wasn't the case in Diderot or Voltaire. They were simply railing against censorship and the opposition encountered towards the publication of the encyclopedia. And what are the sort of, you know, grand implications, the implications of this in terms of what I mean by the terms of censorship and still France considering itself to be a Christian country? When, for example, Louis XVI becomes king in 1774, there is a debate concerning whether he's going to get rid of his coronation oath, an element specifically related to the undoing the attack on heretics. Louis XVI will have none of it, and he swears by the original iteration of the oath against heresy. Again, in contrast to this idea that the enlightened monarch is supposed to be this upholder of religious tolerance. So still, even with Louis XVI, right towards the end of the so-called Ancien Régime, there is the defense of the Edict of Fontainebleau, established by Louis XIV, whereby France has a single religion and it is Catholicism. There is also the point to consider about, you know, referring this back to Louis XV. I've already mentioned the fact that Louis XV is a man dominated by his mistresses. He is a man essentially with no interesting or redeemable features on his own. He's sort of, in terms of, again, assessing him, he just sort of represents a vacuum in power. And the nature of his vices elicits him to be dominated by his mistresses. In particular, we're talking about the Madame de Pompadour, who at least had a bit of a intelligence and cultivation in contrast to Madame de Barry. But in terms of relaying this back to the general sort of licentiousness, on the one hand, we have the Parc-aux-Cerfs controversy, whereby the maitresse en titre, the official mistress, Madame de Pompadour, is servicing the king by importing young, often underage girls from Paris into a little outhouse of Versailles, the Maison en Cerfs, to satisfy his every sexual whim. On the one hand, again, that should be seen as a perverse and indicative of the decay of French society at that time. Nevertheless, there is also a hard political reason as to why Madame de Pompadour would facilitate that. Giving the king his own harem with his own little matrices, his own little madams, essentially means that none of these women can ever be in a position to challenge her authority as maitresse en titre, which is why this system around the Maison aux Cerfs, his own sort of personal harem, dies when Madame de Pompadour dies. And the whole notion of the controversy, the intrigue surrounding who is going to be the official mistress carries on after her death. I think this has to be viewed within its political context, not just as an indication of the deplorable standing of the king. But again, the corollary to that is looking at Marquis de Sade. Sadism is a term which comes from this period, derived from Marquis de Sade himself. Nevertheless, despite the Marquis de Sade's not just libertinism, but celebration and promotion of libertinism, he was regularly chased out of France. He was arrested. He was thrown into Vincennes, and then he was transported to the Bastille, where he wrote his famous 120 Days of Sodom. And after that, he was interned in a mental asylum. And it was only with the inception of the revolution was the Marquis de Sade freed from the Bastille and allowed to go at large in French society. So there was a general prohibition not just against his licentiousness, his sexual antics, but also in particularly he was accused of blasphemy. So despite the general unbelief and antipathy of French society towards religion, officially France remains a Catholic country throughout the duration of this period of the Ancien Régime. There is also another thing to bear in mind, which is the role of Freemasonry in France at this time as well, because this also compounds with this idea that France is becoming weaker vis-a-vis Britain and very much coming into its own sort of cultural sort of imperialist orbit, that being Britain's cultural imperialist orbit, because France has its own iteration of the Masonic Lodge in Paris, the Grand Orient de France, and it'll actually be headed by the cousin of Louis XVI, the Duc d'Orléans, who would later christen himself with a rather preposterous epithet, Philippe Galité. However, what does Masonry in France really represent? There are associated ideas, of course, with it, pantheism, the deism of Voltaire, in contrast to established religion and the Catholic Church. Philippe d'Orléans was also a member of the Society of the Friends of the Constitution, the precursor to the Montagnard faction, more commonly known as the Jacobin faction in France. Nevertheless, what was Masonry in France at this time, but again, one of the importations of cultural and political influence from Britain, which had become a domineering sort of aspect of French political and cultural life, because all of these thinkers in some way are indebted to the legacy and now the power that Britain exerts over French society. There is, however, one exception to this, which is the figure of Jean-Jacques Rousseau on the left, a figure completely ill at ease with French society. He was known to many sort of French notables and in fact performed before the king as a conductor. He was a musician before he was known essentially as a revolutionary. But in contrast to a figure like Voltaire, who was at ease and in fact trying to cultivate the patronage of high society in Europe, Rousseau is always ill at ease with it. He is a vindictive, petty, and rather paranoid figure in contrast to these great philosophical minds who receive the patronage of royalty and nobility. But it is from him that we get this idea of the fundamental rejection of everything that the Ancien Régime stands for, the fundamental rejection of the French monarchy with the term that man is free, but everywhere he is in chains. This idea of the return to nature, but not just a return to nature, but also a return to classicism, a rejection of everything coming out of the medieval mold, the medieval political system, a rejection of feudalism. But combined with this idea of the return to nature, you also have this zealous authoritarianism. Man is free, man must return to nature, but man must also comply with the general will. So it is freedom associated consciously with democracy and totalitarianism. All of these elements, which are overtly opposed to anything that can be offered by the Ancien Régime. So in contrast to when we look at a figure like Voltaire, who's cultivating this idea of the enlightened despot, Rousseau stands in complete contrast to all of this. He also stands in contrast to Montesquieu, who believes that there could be some sort of constitutional remedy to the French political system via some sort of essentially introduction of British parliamentarianism into the French system. And it is to Rousseau that we owe this particular sort of variation of French radicalism, which begins to deviate ever so slightly from the importation of British values, which have essentially been incorporated via Montesquieu and, of course, the various other influences which I have alluded to. Here we get to Louis XVI and the last great attempt to arrest this process. One of the sort of great achievements, which, you know, informs all of our understanding of Louis XVI, I hope, if you have some sort of reference to him, is his patronage and his support of the American revolutionaries. This isn't a policy which is unique to Louis XVI. Very much he is continuing in the vein of his grandfather, Louis XV, who had supported such indirect policies or even Cold War policies, where you support proxy wars among other nations. Louis XV and de Choiseul supported this with the Turkish War against Russia from 1768 until 1774. But again, Louis XV is really indicative of what I mean by France being completely and utterly eclipsed, and how looking at the French Revolution, one has to always construe this within the topic of French demise in Europe, because we've already seen how Britain has come to eclipse France in so many aspects. But now, in the later reign of Louis XV and the early reign of Louis XVI, we see how France has become eclipsed in other aspects of European political theatre as well. So one of the sort of great allies of France, linked to blood through Mary Leziska, the daughter of the King of Poland, Stanislaw, is the French connection to Poland, which will resurface in the Napoleonic period and will also resurface throughout the 19th century. France essentially needs Poland as a great buttress, a potential ally against Austria and Prussia, but also against Russia. But what happens in the course of the 1770s is that we have the failure of the Bar Confederation, and we have the consolidation essentially of a puppet regime, a Russian-led puppet regime in Poland. And after the failure of that regime briefly, we begin to see the wholesale partitioning, dismemberment of Poland from 1772 onwards until 1795. Thereafter, France needs to rely on even sort of stranger allies in the grand concept of things. So it relies on its old alliance with the Ottoman Empire. And later, when you go to Napoleon, you'll also be seeing this French reliance on Persia as a possible ally as well. France is moving further and further afield as representing their general isolation in Europe, even though we've had this diplomatic revolution between Austria and France. So far, the alliance has done nothing to benefit France whatsoever. It has buttressed Mary Theresa in her position, ensured the continuation of Habsburg domination in the Holy Roman Empire, in the south at least, while Frederick II establishes himself in the north. This is a period of great, again, kings, great players in the diplomatic sphere, you know, the greater enlarging of these empires. So Austria expands at the expense of Poland, so does Prussia. Russia expands greatly at the expense of the Ottoman Empire and against Poland. In the context of all of this, whilst also Britain is gaining almost complete domination over North America, it only has to share that with Spain now. What has France acquired during this time? Corsica. For Corsica is the only major acquisition in the later half of the 17th century for France, 18th century for France. And just put that in contrast with the acquisitions of essentially every other great power in Europe. And it's really to the testament of Louis XVI that he's able to facilitate a major reversal for Britain in the successful support of the American revolutionaries from 1776 onwards. But of course, this is mainly sort of known as the moment where France's economic situation becomes, you know, absolutely sort of catastrophic. I don't put too much stock in this idea that the French financial situation again facilitates the revolution. I really think the French financial system needs to be understood as part of the strength of the French regime, because its political strategy, its military strategy, its diplomatic strategy is moving beyond conventional warfare towards supporting proxy wars, now that it is unable effectively to bring about a successful sort of military victory as with Fontenoy. That sort of period of French history is gone, and we won't see it again until the culmination of the French Revolution with the early wars of the Republic and Napoleon. But for now, at least, France is pursuing a strategy of soft power, using its economic might to bring down its enemies. And in America, this works very successfully. And in order to continue this policy, Louis XVI must give the impression to the financiers, mainly Dutch financiers, that France is a capable nation, willing and able to support its debts. And in order to facilitate this, now we have the great crisis of French finances, because we already have the great disaster of the reign of Louis XV. And I think Louis XVI, you can consider him a well-meaning man, a man who was earnestly trying to reform France, a man who was earnestly trying to remedy all of the calamities which had befallen it in the previous 50 years. One of the quotes assigned to him when he becomes king in 1774 is, you know, help us, Lord, because we are too young to rule, also referring to Marie Antoinette, his wife. But really, what happens with Louis XVI is those rare occasions where there isn't going to be a prolonged regency, as was the case with Louis XIV and as was the case with Louis XV. So there was actually great hope associated with the beginning of Louis XVI's reign as ushering in this new period of glory in French history to remedy the disaster of the reign of Louis XV. However, I think the complete sort of, again, the absence of any sort of real strategy in Louis XVI, his incompetence when it comes to politics and political philosophy. I mean, he's a tinkerer. He's a blacksmith. He's known for his appreciation of mechanics and invention, even his own sort of iteration of the guillotine, rather than any sort of savviness with a political program, because he attempts very, very sort of differing reforms led by various domineering ministers against the privileges and the wishes of the nobility in France at that time, often with disastrous results and often with him failing to pursue that strategy to its inevitable end. So he supports Turgot at the beginning, Turgot, who wants to bring about a complete sort of a reform of the French administration, almost in line with what we're seeing in Joseph II, and what would make Louis XVI some equivalent of an enlightened monarch. All of these programs are dedicated towards encroaching upon the ancient privileges and nobility, forcing them to contribute to this system, and therefore solidify and cement French absolutism, but also inculcate this idea of toleration as well, moving away from this idea of a Catholic state, but an Enlightenment state. Turgot fails, and we have the arrival of the Swiss banker from Geneva, Jacques Necker. His ascension is all the more remarkable because he has no faction in court that will support him. He is a Protestant in a state which is still avowedly anti-Protestant. And he is also a self-made man. He is a banker of great acclaim in the state of Europe at that time, so much so that France is able to borrow loans based on essentially the financial reputation of the Controller General of Finances, Jacques Necker, which is all the more incredible. And so we have a self-made man and a Protestant whose sole sort of political constituency is holding on to the king, and Jacques Necker knows this. So Jacques Necker is also quite politically savvy, so he understands that to solidify his position, he must establish his own sort of popularity, his own impression, reputation among the people of France. And it becomes very sort of evident that towards the 1780s and 1770s and 1780s, that Jacques Necker is able to inculcate this idea within the French population that he is the only man in France capable of arresting the financial decline and the general sort of largesse of the French monarchy. And this is a good point to talk about Marie Antoinette, because one of the effects of Jacques Necker is he abolishes many of the extraneous offices of state. He removes any sort of financial sort of excesses among the nobility and on the royal household. And this, of course, makes him very unpopular. And one of the reasons why there is such a conscious move in the court of France to remove him and replace him with Colomb, who you can see here in the center. And again, this is really where the hatred of Marie Antoinette really sort of begins to seep in, and her frivolity, her unqueenly behavior. And when we come to Colomb takes the opposite strategy to Necker. Whilst Necker was focused on economizing the French system, de Colomb believed that trust and confidence in France's economic situation relied on the copious display of largesse. The privileges and nobility, the stipends of the Queen should be restored, and France should spend copiously and it should borrow copiously, because to do anything else would give the impression of crisis. There is certainly an element of truth in that, but it was something that de Colomb did not pursue to the bitter end. I think it's within this context of the lacking of popularity of the Queen, but I would also say the general decline of the aristocracy and of the clergy in particular, that we can look at this weird little moment in French history called the Affair of the Diamond Necklace. We have this trickster, this woman who is sleeping her way up the social ladder, Jeanne de Valois-Saint-Rémy, also known as Jeanne de la Motte, who has seduced a cardinal who was also the Bishop of Strasbourg, Louis René Edouard de Rohan, she's able to lure him into court, suggesting that she actually holds the favor of the Queen. And she actually sort of invites a prostitute to play the role of Marie Antoinette, and who seduces Cardinal de Rohan. And he therefore believes actually that he's having an affair with Marie Antoinette. And she does this in order to receive vast amounts of money from him. And she reaches such a sort of peak of arrogance in the system, where she's able to completely dupe one of the great elder statesmen and members of the higher clergy in France, that she commissions a very expensive jewelry from Bohun de Bissange, which the Cardinal de Rohan on his own cannot actually afford to pay. So instead, de La Motte receives messages, which it sends off messages to the Cardinal, implying that the Queen herself, Marie Antoinette, has given authority or will finance this. This, of course, comes back to Marie Antoinette because the jurors complain that they've essentially been, that the money's been stolen, that the de La Motte has made away with this vast amount of jewelry. And Marie Antoinette has to identify this. Cardinal de Rohan is admonished. And all of this does is actually associate public opinion against Marie Antoinette, because they believe that this was all a ploy for her to destroy one of her political rivals, in this case, it being Cardinal de Rohan. But I think, if anything, this just represents the gullibility, the stupidity, and also the licentiousness of various members of the French clergy at this time, exemplified by Cardinal de Rohan. And it also represents the general sort of air of corruption, which is sort of endemic in the... but also, it also sort of leans on the idea that Marie Antoinette is incredibly sort of spendthrift, excessive. And there's a very public trial which comes out of this, and in the Paris Parlement. Marie Antoinette is very incensed that the Cardinal de Rohan is acquitted by this, and he is not destroyed as a result of this. And this again leads to further implications that Marie Antoinette staged the entire thing to destroy a political rival, which makes her less popular. I think this is a good time to talk about the final sort of moment in terms of the political history of this, which is that de Calonne now understands that his policy has failed, that France needs wholesale reform. And he therefore tries to do this through the assembly of a council of notables. And one of the most stupid things about this is that he's essentially ordering the nobility to the presence of the king to ask the nobility to surrender their privileges on their own volition. Of course, this goes as well as you would expect it to go. De Calonne is destroyed as a result of this. The king brings in another financier, Brienne, to try and remedy the situation once again. But now the effect of the Council of Notables is to not only demonstrate that the French situation is actually, the French financial situation is dire, the impression that de Calonne wanted to cultivate, this idea of France as able to pay its debts through copious spending and largesse, has now been completely dashed. Necker and his commentaries on the state of finance in France are now almost sort of compulsory reading among intellectual circles everywhere, including his own salon, which has been run by his wife, Madame de Necker. And therefore, the state of affairs in France is now known. And the failure of the Council of Notables gives the impression to the Third Estate that the nobility in France and the royal government are incapable of reforming the system of royal finances. So the solution on everyone's lips is to bring forth the Estates General, which hadn't been convened at this point for 175 years. And the expectation of the Estates General is that this would be an opportunity to bring forth the grievances of the Third Estate and perhaps achieve some form of lasting political reform in France, to, in some cases, mirror it on Britain, but in other cases, to go much, much further than what we see in terms of a constitutional monarchy. And this is where I want to read the last sort of segment I have here which is quite long, but nevertheless, I think it's important. It's referring to the idea of Rousseau's philosophy taking hold among the Third Estate in France. Distrust and anger against a government, putting all its fortunes at risk, rancour and hostility against nobility, barring all roads to popular advancement, are then the sentiments developing themselves among the middle class solely due to their advance in wealth and culture. We can imagine the effect of the new philosophy among people with such attitudes. At first confined to the aristocratic reservoir, the doctrine filters on through numerous cracks, like so many trickling streams, to scatter imperceptibly among the lower class. Already in 1727, Barbier, a bourgeois of the old school, and having little knowledge of philosophy and philosophers except the name, writes in his journal, 100 poor families are deprived of the annuities on which they supported themselves, acquired with bonds for which the capital is obliterated. 56,000 livres are given in pensions to people who have the best offices, where they have amassed considerable property, always at the expense of the people, and all this merely that they may rest themselves and do nothing. One by one, reformative ideas penetrate to his office of consulting advocate. Conversion has sufficed to propagate them, homely common sense needing no philosophy to secure their recognition. The tax on property, said he in 1750, should be proportioned and equally distributed among all the king's subjects and the members of the government in proportion to the property each can really possess in the kingdom. In England, the lands of the nobility, the clergy, and the third estate pay alike without distinction, and nothing is more just. In the 6 years which follow, the flood increases. People denounce the government in the cafes, on their promenades, while the police dare not arrest malcontents, because they would have to arrest everybody. The dissatisfaction goes on increasing up to the end of the reign. In 1744, this is the reign of Louis XV, in 1744, says the bookseller Hardy, during the king's illness at Metz, private individuals caused 6,000 masses to be said for his recovery and pay them for the sacristy of Notre Dame. In 1757, after Damiens' attempts on the king's life, the number of masses demanded is only 600. And again, this is also completely corresponding with the fall in the fortunes of the reign of Louis XV and the fortunes of France from 1744 to 1757. After Damiens' attempt on the king's life, the number of masses demanded is only 600. And of course, this is the famous moment after which if there was an attempt on his life, he considers himself near fatal, has this sort of brief religious conversion, and then goes back to his vices. In 1774, during the malady which carries him off, the number falls down to 3. So we go originally from his original smallpox in 1744, Louis XV, 6,000 masses said, to 3 when he reaches his final malady. The complete discredit of the government, the immediate success of Rousseau, these two events occurring simultaneously afford a date for the conversion of the Third Estate to the philosophy, i.e. the philosophy of the philosophes. A traveller at the beginning of the reign of Louis XVI, who returns home after some years' absence, on being asked what change he noticed in the nation, he replied, "Nothing, except that what used to be talked about in the drawing rooms is repeated in the streets." And that which is repeated in the streets is Rousseau's doctrine, the discourse on inequality, the social contract amplified, popularized, and repeated by adherents in every possible way and in all their forms. What could be more fascinating for the man of the Third Estate? Not only is this theory in vogue and encountered him at the decisive moment when, for the first time, he turns his attention to general principles, but again it provides him with arms against social inequality and political absolutism, and much sharper than he needs. To people disposed to put restraints on power, and to the orator who establishes natural law, who repudiates historical law, who proclaims the equality of men, who contends for the sovereignty of the people, who denounces on every page the usurpation, the vices, the worthlessness, the malefactions of the great and of the king. And I admit the points by which he makes acceptable to a rigid and laborious bourgeoisie, to the new men that are working and advancing themselves, his steady earnestness, his harsh and bitter tone, his eulogy of simple habits, of domestic virtues, of personal merit, of virile energy, the commoner addressing commoners. It is not surprising that they should accept him as a guide and welcome his doctrine with the fervour of a faith called enthusiasm, and which invariably accompanies the newborn idea as well as the first love. to Mallet Dupin, writing in 1799, 10 years after the French Revolution, Rousseau had 100 times more readers among the middle and lower classes than Voltaire. He alone inculcated the French with the doctrine of the sovereignty of the people and with its extremist consequences. It would be difficult to cite a single revolutionary who was not transported over these anarchical theories and who did not burn with the ardor to realize them. That contract social, the disintegrator of societies, was the Quran of the pretentious talkers of 1789, of the Jacobins of 1790, of the Republicans of 91, and the most atrocious of the madmen. I heard Morat in 1788 read on the comment of the contrat social in the public streets to the applause and enthusiastic auditory. The same year, in an immense throng in the great hall of the Palais de Justice, Lacretelle hears that same book quoted. Its dogmas put forward by the clerks of La Basoche, by members of the bar, by young lawyers, by the ordinary letter classes, swarming with new-fledged specialists in public law. Hundreds of details show us that in every hand like a catechism. In 1784, certain magistrate's sons, on taking their first lesson in jurisprudence of an assistant professor, M. Sevest, have the contract social placed in their hands as a manual. Those who find this new political geometry too difficult learn at least its axioms, and if these repel them, they discover at least their palpable consequences. So many handy companions, the trifling common practice in the literature in vogue, whether drama, history, or romance. Through the Eloges by Thomas, the Pastorals of Bernardin de Saint-Pierre, the compilation of Raynal, the comedy of Beaumarchais, and even the young anarchists, and the literature of the resuscitated Greek and Roman antiquity. The dogmas of equality and liberty infiltrate and penetrate the class able to read. A few days ago, says Maître, a dinner of 40 ecclesiastics from the country took place at the house of the curate of Orangis, 5 leagues from Paris. At the desert and the truth which came out of their wine, they all admitted that they came to Paris to see the Marriage of Figaro. Up to the present time, it seems as if comic authors intended to make support for the great at the expense of the little. But here, on the contrary, it is little who laughed at the expense of the great. Hence the success of the piece, hence the steward of a chateau has found at Raynal in the library the furious declamation of which he so delights him, that he can repeat in 30 years later without stumbling, or a sergeant in French guards embroiders waistcoat during the night to earn money with which to purchase the latest books. After the gallant picture of the boudoir comes the austere and patriotic picture. Belle Isaurie of the Horatio of David reflect the new attitude both of the public and of the studios. And of course, sorry, that's Belisarius and Horatii. The spirit is that of Rousseau, the Republican spirit. The entire middle class, artists, employers, curates, physicians, attorneys, advocates, the lettered and the journalists are all won over to it. And it is fed by the worst as well as the best passions, ambition, envy, desire for freedom, zeal for the public welfare, and the consciousness of right. And with that implication, that is going to set us up quite nicely for when we discuss the French Revolution at some point. I'm not sure when I'm going to get around to doing the French Revolution. My schedule is a bit hectic at the moment. And the topic of doing the French Revolution in a single stream, I'm honestly do find rather daunting, as if I can manage to talk about the entirety, a summary of the French Revolution in a single lecture, which doesn't become some sort of a basic chronicle or sort of shopping list of events. I really hope it doesn't become that. But I'm here. I'm here to answer your questions. I have one super chat which was sent a long time ago on this stream when this was originally supposed to broadcast last Saturday. So if you want to send any super chats or send a question, do so now while I'm reading out the super chat. AJSJ says for $10, thank you very much. I saw you earlier in the chat, by the way. So I hope you're still around where you can listen to this. I am indeed reading your super chat. AM, did you hear of the Mad Monarchist blog? It's been defunct for a couple of years, but profoundly shaped my political views. and in a way led me directly to you. P.S. Columba is a comedic genius. Yes, I have heard of the Mad Monarchist blog. Yes, I haven't sort of checked it out for many, many years. I'm sorry to hear it's not still going. But I was aware of it. In terms of it influencing my ideas, I wouldn't go that far. But I think it was nice. It was a fun little website, and I think it's a shame if it has indeed gone defunct, and if it can facilitate your path to legitimism or sort of monarchy in general, then I'm very happy for you, AJSJ. As for Columba, absolutely, he's not just a comedic genius, but very much appreciated on this channel, and I really do value his insights, and I'm really glad that he can come on for the discussion portions, and he can indulge me my continued expansive ramblings on these various subjects. Indeed, that is a compliment I would extend to my entire audience. I still don't understand why so many of you listen to me, but anyway, it seems that that's all the listening to me you're going to have to tolerate for this evening, because there are no more super chats and there are no more questions, despite my imploring to send me questions. I'll quickly go back, but for fear of dead air, I'm not going to be able to dwell on them too often. Okay, going right back to the beginning of the stream, Justin the Catholic, can you talk about Jacques de Molay and his execution? Did someone sprinkle blood on the crowd at Louis the 16th execution and mention his name? I know he was executed. Beyond that, I really don't know that much about Jacques de Molay, other than his role in the general affair concerning the diamond necklace. I'm not sure what the implication would be if Louis the 16th was in some way implicated. I mean, the finding of the Paris Parlement was that the de Molettes were relying on the stupidity and the licentiousness of Cardinal de Rohan, and the impression that Marie Antoinette essentially was trying to, you know, woo him back into his favor to make a vast amount of money. And of course they did. I'm not sure what the implication would be for Louis the 16th. And again, whether this will be some sort of prophetic link back to the French Revolution, I don't really see the connection, I'm afraid. People are asking me to do a breakdown of Ukraine and Russia, and I believe I have, if you want to check it out. France also got into huge debt supporting the Americans at war of... Yes, but the reason they do that, Iron Duke, again, is because of the transition away from conventional warfare to proxy wars. And therefore, this relies on the impression of France's soft power at a time where France is very much a shadow of its former self towards the end of the 18th century, thanks to the disastrous policies of Louis the 15th. So I think it was a clever strategy, but again, it relies on this impression of France's financial capabilities, which is completely shattered with the failure of the Council of Notables in 1788. Right. Yes, I've just read your question, Justin the Catholic. You're just asking me to send me a question again. Joseph Langmead for £1.79. Interesting. I didn't realize you could actually give Super Chat money. It's not that, that was that specific. Anyway, thank you, Joseph Langmead. Opinions on the 1814 Liberal Charter. Too generous. Well, it's not really relevant, apart from me using that as, you know, a segue into the division of the legitimist camp and the restoration period as my introduction to this stream. It was certainly considered far too generous at the time. And after the defeat of Napoleon in the 100 Days campaign, which culminated in Waterloo, it resulted in what you can say a moral panic, or a major sort of blue wave, a red scare in France, targeting anyone who was seen to be in any way culpable or associated with Napoleon, crypto-revolutionaries, so to speak. And this is why the Liberal Charter was so derided by legitimists after Napoleon's fall, because essentially Louis XVIII was considered as having surrendered far too much, and having been rewarded for his liberality by being usurped and betrayed by the wholesale court, switching over to supporting Napoleon with a couple of exceptions. And so after Napoleon's second fall, you have token purges, such as that of Machonnet, who was a key, essentially, character in facilitating Napoleon's rise to power in the Hundred Days, but also his disaster at Waterloo. So the reaction against that and the perception of generosity and backstabbing of crypto-revolutionaries against Louis XVIII was to assemble, or rather disassemble, the Chamber of Deputies as the Chambre Introuvable, the introuvable, the unfindable chamber. The interesting thing is, though, that despite the reactionary wave, which would have supported, you know, real legitimism and was taken up by the Comte d'Artois, who would later become Charles X, Louis XVIII didn't go along with the policies and continued upholding the Liberal Charter. In fact, the monarch that the Restorationists looked to wasn't Louis XIV, it was Henry IV, Henri IV, as a king who was the founder of the Bourbon dynasty, but was considered far more tolerant and invested in the plight of the common people, as opposed to Louis XIV, who before the revolution was known as Louis le Grand, but after the French Revolution, Louis XVIII and his immediate circle thought was rather embarrassing. Of course, this was very much derided by legitimists. John Hawkins for £2. Cheers for Stream AM. Well, thank you very much, John Hawkins. It's very much appreciated. John Gordon for $4.99. Would you agree that support for the American Revolution guaranteed the French Revolution? No. Like I said, I think obviously there is the connection. You have, you know, one of the most pertinent connections being the hero of two revolutions, Lafayette, coming over with a burning zeal for French sort of constitutionalism after the war, having facilitated Washington's victory in the American Independence War. There are connections like that. And I think the effect of the American Revolution was enough to give the philosophes a ready-made zeal. But nevertheless, I think all of these ideas, which had already been filtering into French society from the American Revolution, had already entered French society by way of Montesquieu and the influence of Britain in the 1740s and the 1750s. What we see with the American Revolution is simply the chrysalis of, you know, essentially the identification of those values and the attempt to put Montesquieu's political theories into practice in America. So really, it's just an intensification of ideas which had already been taking place in France over the previous 50 years. That's one angle to look at it. So therefore, the French population was already radicalized by the death of Louis XV, and it didn't really need any further radicalization, albeit there were certain figures like Lafayette who would play a major role in the early stages of the French Revolution. In terms of the role of, you know, messing up French finances, which has already been alluded to. Yes, that did have a major role. But I think if France failed, France was doomed either way. If France failed to take this opportunity to support the French revolutionaries, to support the American revolutionaries, Louis the 16th would have been hated as a king who was unable to take the chance to upset the balance of power in France's favor. Whereas if he supported them, he would risk not only bringing more revolutionaries back home, but invite, you know, have to spend vast amounts of money in giving material support and military aid to the American revolutionaries. So if he did nothing, it would have been disastrous for him. I think he actually made the right choice. And like I said, it's very much continuous with the policy of the French government from the Chausseur. From 1768, where France moved from conventional warfare to proxy warfare. And I think Louis XVI was far more successful in that than Louis XV ever was. I just think it's unfortunate for him that he inherited a situation which was essentially untenable But I think the support of the American War of Independence was actually one of the last great diplomatic triumphs of France, albeit the damage had already been done. France had gone from being the dominant power in Europe, indeed one of the principal maritime powers, and by the reign of Louis XVI, all France could do was upset the hegemony of Britain. So again, I really can't blame Louis XVI for that. A very poor man, a weak man, but a good man in a terrible situation. There was a moment in particular on which the whole situation could be reversed. If Britain turned Puritan after the licentiousness Rescennial period rather than quickly, then why couldn't the French? Are you talking about the Commonwealth and talking about Cromwell? I'm not sure sort of what you're talking about in particular. Are you referring to, I think you'll have to K14, Y29, you'll have to embellish on that, because that's an interesting idea, but I can't quite grasp your situation. I mean, what happened in Britain is that obviously Britain was France's ally for a long period of time in the 16th and the 17th centuries. And Cromwell, again, similar to Napoleon, did conceive of expanding Britain, expanding it into South America, expanding it into the Caribbean at the expense of the Spanish Empire. In the case of Cromwell, also consolidating control of the British Isles. And then there was a relaxation of such policies when we have the Restoration under Charles II. So there is a similar situation as to what happened with Napoleon. And Napoleon is therefore the obvious comparison to draw. The difference is that Cromwell left Britain in a better diplomatic military position than when he found it, whereas Napoleon took France to the summit of its glory. However, the fundamental failure of the continental system meant that France was unable to reverse what had been delivered in 1763 with the defeat of France in the Seven Years' War. Because the continental system essentially had to succeed, Europe had to be united in its economic blockade against Britain to defeat it as a maritime power in order for Napoleon to overturn the results of that war, and it failed. And as we can see, I almost feel that that policy was doomed regardless, because the logic of that policy necessitated more wars, more unrest, poverty, centralization, all of these things that made the French incredibly unpopular by 1812. And all it took was one military disaster to undo all of the gains of the French Revolution and Napoleon in 2 years. But there was definitely an attempt to reverse that, and it was Napoleon. Right. The Industrial Revolution was much more advanced in Britain than in France and made Britain a richer nation. Well, it wasn't that pronounced in 1750. Britain was obviously starting the Industrial Revolution at that time, but I believe it was the unfettered control of trade and maritime dominance which really sort of kicked Britain off as a major financial power. And also, I think, for the first time, actually made it replace the Dutch. There's also another point to mention, which is that the Dutch were one of the great lending powers. Amsterdam was still, at this time in the 18th century, the great banking capital of Europe. And it is also during this time that the Netherlands essentially becomes almost exclusively a financial power. It loses its maritime dominance to Britain. And towards the end of this period, the Netherlands is occupied by Prussia. And then it is forcefully incorporated into France, the Batavian Republic, then the Batavian Kingdom. And the Netherlands never recovers the preeminent position it held in the 17th and the 18th centuries. It's an overall strict social conduct, Victorian evangelism, anti-blasphemy laws, etc. Okay, I think I sort of answered your question, though, in reference to Cromwell and Napoleon. Glock Smith, this is an unrelated topic, but do you think Cornwall period in Great Britain is underrated? Cromwell, I assume you mean. He was not a king, but also not an absolutist, the only person who was able to unite all the British Isles. But he was an absolutist. I think the implication of him refusing the title of a king is that as Lord Protector,
his title, his powers were ambiguous. Therefore, he could do anything. Ironically, the Lord Protector was probably more powerful and less constrained than any king, any ruler, in fact, until very recently. The whole sort of implication of the Cromwellian period under the Lord Protector meant that for the first time, Britain was under a legally unconstrained military dictatorship, which is something that has never really happened. It's a one-off in our history. By the 1780s, Britain industry was a fair bit more advanced than France. Yes, absolutely. But nevertheless, my point was going back to the 1750s, where the British had already dealt the French the major blow. It is a combination of maritime dominance and industrial innovation, which gave Britain the edge in the late 18th century and for the certainly the first half of the 19th century. Right. I do find it ironic that Thomas Hobbes left Cromwellian England for France. But he was also an apologist for Cromwell as well, as a being able to prevent the state of war against all, which he believed was the state of nature. Right, I think that's about 15, 20 minutes I've given for questions. I think that's going to be enough for me this evening. So thank you all for listening and thank you for your wonderful questions. Just in terms of what's happening next, there will be a discussion on Monday with Columba, where we'll be discussing various aspects which have been covered here in more depth. In particular, Columba wants to discuss Thomas Carlyle's interpretation of the French revolutionaries and, of course, some literary connotations such as the betrayal of the French nobility in A Tale of Two Cities and things like that. So if you want to listen more about this, then do check in on that discussion episode, and thank you all very much for listening. In terms of when this is going to come back, like I said, I'm a bit scattered at the moment. So I will promise you that I will do at least one stream a week. So next week, it'll be the continuation of the Lord of the Rings series, Daragne. And after that, I'll probably do the French Revolution. I hope I can do the French Revolution. I hope it's not going to be a disaster. So thank you all very much for listening, and good night.